Lecture 4. The Exercise of Political Power in Athens.
In the last lecture, we saw how the tyrants of the Archaic period came to power by expelling the ruling families because they were doing little for the ordinary people. And they were also contributing to the instability of society with their exploitive rules or their faction fighting or both. This fact, in other words, what was going on in other polis, would not have been lost on the eupatridae, the well-born, in Athens. These were the aristocratic families, remember, who were in control of the government at Athens. However, these eupatridae continued to rule as they always had done. They disregarded the needs and wants of the ordinary people, and they disregarded any appeals about their plight. And so we have a scenario for civil war. And against it, the eventual development of democracy and a legal code, thanks to the work of Dracon, and especially Solon, who is commonly called the father of democracy. In this lecture, we're going to talk about the nature of political power at Athens and the Athenian constitution before Solon. It's only by having a good grasp of these things that we can really appreciate the revolutionary nature of Solon's legislation, and then later the legislation of other democratic reformers, men like Cleisthenes and Ephialtes, who built on what Solon started. Incidentally, this Cleisthenes is not the tyrant of Sicyon, whom we talked about in our last lecture, but Cleisthenes the Athenian. We're also going to discuss, in more detail than in the last lecture, the emergence of the hoplite style of warfare, and how it and the hoplite soldiers came to apply pressure on the existing regime. We're able to discuss the Athenian constitution and its development because of the treatise called the Athenian Constitution, which is attributed to Aristotle. Now, this was found in 1891, which for ancient history is like yesterday, and it pretty much rewrote Athenian history overnight. The first part of the Athenian Constitution is a history of its development, and the second part is a discussion of the workings of the Constitution in the author's own day. It was probably written in the 330s BC and revised in the 320s BC, and so it's looking back over the whole period of archaic and classical Greek history. And it's written at a time when Greece had become part of the Macedonian Empire, thanks to Philip II. The Athenian Constitution was not written by Aristotle, hence I use the word attributed. People who know far more about these things than I do can show that its style is very different compared to the works that we do know Aristotle wrote. So the common opinion is that the Athenian Constitution was written by one of the students at his school, at Aristotle's school. Among other things, Aristotle's school was responsible for collecting and studying the constitutions of 158 polis, but only the Athenian one survived, and as I said, it wasn't discovered till 1891. Even then, parts of the Athenian one are missing, including the beginning and the ending. Nevertheless, what it tells us is vital, because it gives us a blow-by-blow account of how the constitution developed against the backdrop of history. Oh, just imagine how much more we'd know about Greek history if we had all 158 of those constitutions, or even half of them, a quarter of them. We got nothing. Now, we're told in the Athenian constitution that in our period, that's the early archaic, there were three organs to the constitution: the archons, the areopagus, and the assembly. And I'd like to discuss each one of these in turn, starting with the first, the archons. Athens was governed by three top magistrates called archons, which we might translate as leaders. In Greek constitutional history, magistrate doesn't have the legal identification as it does today. It merely means official or politician. Occasionally, we hear of other titles for leaders in states. For example, in Corinth, the magistrates were called prytanes, which is something like presiding officials. But generally speaking, throughout Greece, archon is the most common term for magistrate, politician, leader. Now, these three archons seemed to share equal power, and they were in charge of the polis's religious, military, and civic life. In the Archaic period, tenure of the archonship, that's the office of archon, was for 1 year, and re-election was not possible. Before this time, that's before the Archaic period, the archonships had been lifelong at first, then for 10 years, and finally annual. Probably this was to ensure some turnover in men who held the office, though let's not forget that these men were always drawn from the ranks of the Eupatridae in Athens. So you might have different faces and different names, but the ideology never changed. It doesn't really matter what the state was. The aristocrats were always in charge of political life. The ordinary people, the non-nobles that is, couldn't stand for political office in the early archaic period. As we know, the aristocrats controlled the polis when the monarchies fell in the Bronze Age. So the various duties of the king seem to have been parceled out among a number of upper crust individuals. At the same time, any public gatherings on the part of the people that had taken place in the Bronze Age were either severely curtailed or abolished. Now, there had to have been some gatherings of people during the Bronze Age, possibly even during the Dark Ages. Otherwise, it's hard to explain why the organ called the Assembly, which was a public one, theoretically open to all citizens, remained in existence in our early constitution. But a word of warning here. This doesn't mean that the people in the Bronze Age had political power. It's more likely that there would have been occasions when the king summoned his people together, for example, when he heard disputes or when he dispensed justice, or when he held the equivalent of a modern political information forum, not a town hall meeting. Now, the earliest of these three archonships was the Basileus Archon, and he had various religious duties on behalf of the state. This was a very important office because religion went hand in hand with Greek daily life. The Greeks at this time believed that the gods controlled all aspects of human affairs and that they popped down to earth, or up for that matter, and assumed human form. It was crucial not to upset them, and for individuals and cities, equally crucial to remain in the gods' good graces. And they could do this via sacrifice and worship. The Basileus Archon then assumes a special importance because it's to him that falls the pressure of keeping the state in the gods' good graces. Now, it's interesting that in Greek the word Basileus means king, which to me gives us a continuity from the Bronze Age king. The word, that's Basileus, may have been deliberately retained to get people used to a transition period in the exercise of political power. In other words, the transition period from monarchy to oligarchy. And then, as the other two archons were added, Basileus was simply kept, as everyone was used to it by then. It had become traditional. We find the word outside Athens as well. For example, Sparta had a dual kingship in its constitution. We'll discuss this in more detail when we get to the Spartan lectures. But these two kings always came from the same families, but they were part of the constitution, and they were kept in check by other officials. It seems that the primary function of the dual kingship in Sparta was military. And here's another place, a small town in Boeotia called Askra, which had Thespiae as its polis. In Hesiod's mini-epic poem, The Works and Days, written about 700 BC, we have the plural form of Basileus, Basileis. Now, Hesiod is a small farmer who lives in this place called Askra in Boeotia. And in his poem, Hesiod is having a go at his brother Perses, who is not being a good brother or even a good farmer because he's swindled Hesiod out of some of his inheritance. The two of them evidently went to judges to settle the dispute. But Perses bribed them, that's bribed the jurors, the judges, to find in his favour. So Hesiod wrote this poem as a way of sounding off at his brother and those judges. The term used by Hesiod for them is Basileis. So this gives us a tiny insight into another place in Greece apart from Athens. But let's go back to Athens. Our second magistrate, that's the one after the Basileus Archon, our second magistrate was the Polymarchos Archon, and he was in charge of military affairs. Polymos is the Greek word for war. Now, this official was clearly important. He was in charge of state security and all military operations. But we should remember that the archons were always drawn from the Eupatridae in this period. Now, as everyone knows, it doesn't necessarily follow that those who obtain an office because of their birth can do the job well. And clearly, as relations between Athens and other states, especially Sparta, deteriorated in the Archaic period, it became essential that the person in charge of military affairs should know what he was doing. This is even more so with the rise of the hoplite soldier. And I'd like to deal in more detail with hoplites now. I mentioned them in the previous lecture. Now we're going to get to grips with them a little bit more. Around the first quarter of the 7th century or so, we get a radical change in Greek warfare. This radical change is the introduction of the hoplite army. Now, this is about the same time, remember, as Phaidon was seizing power in Argos. Now, these hoplites were infantrymen, and the innovation was that they were trained to fight together in a close formation called the phalanx. They didn't fight individually as they used to. Now they had to fight together. Moreover, they were now to use new spears for thrusting as opposed to throwing like before, and swords for hand-to-hand fighting. Now, to protect themselves, they wore helmets, cuirasses, greaves, and they carried a new shield called a hoplon, and that gave them their name, hoplite. This hoplon was made of wood, it was covered by bronze, and the hoplites held onto it with their left forearms by means of straps on its inside. We're fortunate to have a vase from Corinth dated to about 650 or so BC called the Chigi Vase. And on this is painted a hoplite battle. It appears that the men in the phalanx were really tightly jammed together and that the shield that each man carried was large. It's about 3 to 4 feet in diameter. Moreover, it was less to protect him than the man to his left. Now, the hoplites in their phalanxes seem to have charged the opposing line, thrusting their spears at the enemy to pick as many of them off as they could before they smashed into that line and engaged it in hand-to-hand combat until victory went to one of the two sides. The fighting in a hoplite battle was intense and brutal. The hoplites were hampered by heavy equipment, by poor visibility through their helmets. It was not pleasant. Nevertheless, this method of fighting in close formation in the phalanx soon became standard for the Greek city-states. Now, the hoplite army was not a professional army by any means. The soldiers were mostly farmers or traders from the middle and perhaps even the lower upper classes. They didn't serve full-time, and the type of fighting they did was unsophisticated by later standards. However, Since the hoplites had to provide their own weapons and armor, the state couldn't afford to provide them, by the way. Only those who could afford to do this sort of fighting were hoplites. Only those who could afford the arms and armor were the hoplite soldiers. The lowest social stratum couldn't afford this, so they weren't hoplites. Now, what that meant, of course, was that noblemen from the upper classes, as well as wealthy non-nobles, fought side by side. Either one of these could just as easily be killed by the enemy, and either one was protected by the hoplite soldier's shield to his right. Now, that also meant that the hoplites became a critical part of the state. I mean, after all, they defended the polis in times of war. Yet, think about it. These hoplites had no political rights, because the Eupatridae run things as a matter of course. So it's no surprise that given the importance of the hoplite army in the state, that these hoplite soldiers would want more of a say in its political life. And we can add their agitation, their political agitation, to the farmers' social and economic plight. Remember, the farmers are the hectameroi who could be sold into slavery after their lands were seized by their aristocratic neighbours. So all of a sudden, we've gone from social and economic grievances to political with the hoplite. Finally, to get back to our archons, the third archon in Athens was the eponymous archon. He was the chief civil minister in the state, who was basically in charge of everything the other two archons weren't. He would become the most important of the archons, and the faction fighting over the archonship that plagues Athenian history for much of the 6th century is about the eponymous archonship. It's not about the other two. Now, the title of this archon, eponymous, comes from the practice of the Athenians naming their year after the man who was eponymous archon. And this is how the Greeks reckoned their chronology. So, in our sources, both literary and epigraphic, those sources are written on stones, we often see the formula in the archonship of, and that's followed by a man's name. And this shows that whatever was going to be described or discussed happened in that man's archonship. So, for example, in the Athenian constitution, we're told that Dracon's legislation was, and I quote, in the archonship of Aristaechmus. And this is usually placed in about 621 BC. So that's how the Greeks reckoned their chronology. The Romans did the same thing, but they named their year after the two consuls for that year. So you'd see in our sources something, the phrase like, in the consulship of, and then there would be two Roman names. So as far as our magistrates in the constitution go, we have three archons, Basileus, Polymarchus, and the eponymous, each with specific functions. Now, these three are the top dogs, because under them, there were six thesmothetae. Now, the word thesmothetae means something like those who lay down the rules. And they seem to have been assistants to the archons who carried out their orders. Now, whether these six thesmothetae came into being at the same time as the archons, or whether they were a later addition, is not really known. The Athenian constitution talks about them coming into being, quote, many years later than the archons, at a time when the archons' tenure of office was an annual one. So I think we should go with the Athenian constitution, simply because that author is using sources that are lost to us, and he knows more about what he's saying than we do. So perhaps when there was some redefining of the archon's term of office, perhaps when it was chopped back from a 10-year tenure to an annual one, another magistracy was created. And to me, it makes more sense to see these thesmothetae as being introduced later, when the three archons presumably found that they couldn't handle business themselves, and so they needed secretaries or assistants. Now, as time continued and the legal system in particular developed, these magistrates acquired specific judicial functions. So the Basileus Archon, as we might guess, judged cases that had to do with religion, such as a dispute concerning a sacrifice, or if someone was involved in a dispute at a religious festival, perhaps being assaulted. That's the sort of thing that the gods would not like, by the way. The Polemarch Archon, that's the one in charge of military affairs, judged cases involving resident aliens, or metics as they were technically called. And the Eponymous Archon, that's our chief civil minister, judged civil cases, that's any civil cases that didn't involve religion, such as family and property matters, guardianship, whether someone had buried a dead parent in accordance with the laws, that type of thing. As for the Thesmothetae, they also assumed judicial powers, including introducing a case to court. Now we move to the second organ in the pre-Solonian constitution, the constitution before Solon, and that's the Council of the Areopagus. Now this was a permanent council of nobles, which presumably grew out of the Bronze Age Boule, or the King's Advisory Council. The name gives nothing away about its origins, by the way. Areopagus. Well, Ares is the god of war. Pagos is the Greek word for hill. So put these together and we get Hill of Ares. And this was a big rocky outcrop close to the Acropolis. So this is where the Areopagus met, meaning the council took its name from its meeting place. Now, it was obviously aristocratic in composition because it was noble. And according to the Athenian constitution, it was guardian of the laws. Now, we have a ton of comments in later sources about how the well-being of Athens is anchored in the laws. So this council, the Areopagus, had enormous power in the state. The Areopagus was composed of ex-archons who were members for life. In other words, when the archon finished his one-year term, he became a member of the Areopagus, and he stayed in it till he died. This meant that the council was slowly increasing in number over the years, but its political ideology never changed. In tandem with the archons, the Areopagus controlled the state. In reality, come to think of it, it probably dominated the archons. I mean, they don't want to get on the Areopagus' bad side, otherwise they might be denied becoming a member of it when the term of office came to an end. So they're going to do what the members of the Areopagus tell them to do. Now, the Hill of Ares is today easily seen from the entranceway in the top of the Acropolis. Today, you can climb up steps to get to the top of the Hill of Ares and you can walk around on top of it. At the right time of year, I was there one time in November, there's hardly anyone around. So you can walk to the top of the Areopagus, you can sit almost alone on top of the hill. And with the Acropolis to your right, and looking out over the Agora, that's the marketplace of Athens, and if you twist a bit and look over your left shoulder, you can just see the Pnyx, the area where that third organ, the assembly, met. Well, if you're sitting up there looking around at all these things, it's not that hard to switch off from the sound of the city and the power lines overhead and to imagine what it must have been like when the members of this council collected there, sitting on top of this rock and debating about what to do next in the running of Athens. Becomes almost a magical experience. Our final organ of the pre-Solonian constitution was the Assembly of the People. This was called Ecclesia, and it met on the Pnyx. This was another huge rocky outcrop close to the Acropolis. There's a ton of rocky outcrops in Athens, isn't there? I'm making it sound as if you can't walk down a street without falling over one. But anyway, the Assembly was the democratic organ of the constitution, where supposedly all citizens could meet. Perhaps its origins lay in some meeting of the people that our Bronze Age king called when he wanted to talk about affairs of state or when he dispensed justice. He would call an assembly. We just don't know. However, by the time we move into the Archaic period, it's no surprise that the Eupatrid oligarchy ensured the assembly did not meet. What could it have done under an oligarchy anyway? Perhaps the Eupatridae left this organ on the books because to abolish it would cause too much discontent. Then again, if they're happy seeing citizens who are theoretically equal being sold into slavery, I don't think they cared a hoot about popular discontent. On the other hand, though, perhaps one of my heresies here, they may have occasionally summoned the people together for public announcements and the like, much like the Bronze Age king gathering the people together to inform them about what he was doing, dispensing justice, this sort of thing. Now, if the Eupatridae did that, then it means that they would summon an assembly, but this was only when they felt like it, and it was almost an information forum. Now, things will change, of course, as time goes on. The assembly especially will become a powerful body in the developed democracy. It will decide all matters of domestic and foreign policy. In the later 4th century, as many as 13,400 citizens could be accommodated in the auditorium area on top of the Pnyx. We'll talk a little bit more about that down the track. And what's more, the assembly would come to be used as a springboard to individual political power. So let's just recap, because there are a lot of funny words in this lecture and a lot of information. At the start of the Archaic period, and before the legislation of Solon in 594, the Athenian constitution has three components to it, or three organs. We have the nine archons, or magistrates, with three of them, the Basileus, the Polymarchus, and the Eponymus, being the most important, what I call the top dogs. They're supported by six thesmothetae, who are something like assistants to them or secretaries. We just don't know for sure what else they might have done. All of these nine officials were elected, or rather selected, an important difference, from the Eupatridae. Second, there was the Council of the Areopagus. This was an aristocratic body of ex-archons who were members for life. The archons and the Areopagus in tandem were responsible for all aspects of state administration. The importance of the Areopagus is shown by our sources, like the Athenian constitution, that tells us the Areopagus was charged with guarding the laws. Now that is a phrase that comes up time and time again. Without law, there's anarchy. Therefore, the Areopagus was charged with preventing that anarchy. And hence, it becomes all powerful in the administration. The archons then become almost like its officers carrying out policy, like a mob boss and his captains. Third and final in our constitution, there was the assembly, the people's organ. Now this didn't meet, or if it did, it was only at the whim of the ruling aristocrats, and it certainly didn't debate or make policy, there's no question about that. Solon was going to change all that, and Ephialtes in 462 was going to take Athenian politics in a radically new direction, as we'll see. Athens of the classical period would eventually have a plethora of elected officials. One of my favorite words, plethora. The vast majority of these officials had specific functions. Officials in charge of trade or the marketplace. Officials in charge of the corn supply or who were responsible for allegations of bad business practice. And then there were the strategoi, the professional generals who could be re-elected, or the 11, this enigmatic body that seems to have been a type of police force that was also in charge of the prison. Athens was one of the larger polis, and so it needed more officials, hundreds in fact, to administer it in the classical democracy. Now this political system, this classical democracy that we owe so much to, this would not have come about without the political innovations of the 6th century, which began with the work of Dracon and Solon. And it's to Dracon that we turn in our next lecture. Thank you very much.